Last Sunday, something extraordinary happened on the island of Cuba. People emerged from their homes, talked into their smartphones. Filled with frustration and anger, they called on each other to take to the streets and say enough.
Pueblo de Cuba, llegó el momento, señores.
People of Cuba, the moment has arrived. Let's head into the streets and fight for freedom. Let's put an end to this bloody dictatorship and chant for our freedom. Down with communism, down with Díaz-Canel.
Abajo el comunismo, abajo Díaz-Canel.
And take to the streets they did, in cities and towns across the island. In numbers not seen since Cuba's communist regime came to power more than 60 years ago. They demanded food, medical supplies, electricity, and dignity. They chanted Patria y Vida, homeland and life, a defiant twist on the revolutionary slogan, homeland or death. They sang the national anthem. They shouted perhaps the most threatening words any regime can hear from its own people. We are not afraid. And then came the crackdown. Since Sunday, the protests seem to have been sporadic, but the arrests and the beatings in homes and on the streets have not. This was a social media uprising, so the government blacked out most of the island's internet. Today, it began to slowly return, revealing images and videos of the regime's crackdown to the outside world. So where are things now? Where are they going? And this, that's nearly impossible to say, but Cubans say this time is different. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This hour, the people of Cuba, why they took to the streets, and where this goes next. Joining me from Madrid, Spain, is Mónica Baró. She is a Cuban independent journalist. She fled to Spain in January because of threats to herself and her family. Mónica, welcome.
Thanks, Kim. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yes, thank you. And from St. Louis, we're joined by Orlando Pardo Lazo. He's an artist, writer, and blogger, and he left Cuba in 2013. Orlando, welcome to you too.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with Mónica. What do we know is happening now? We stopped getting images from the protests when the internet in Cuba went down. But what do we know about what happened between Sunday and now and where things currently stand?
Well, actually, after Sunday, the streets of Cuba in different places started to be repressed by the police and the army, and also by civil groups that were in a way directed by the authorities, because the president made the order of going out to the streets and defend the revolution. And what we are seeing right now is that there's a very weird calm or in a way a quiet place in Cuba. Mm-hmm. There's no one in the streets, and there are a lot of people reporting disappearances and detained people. There are families that don't have any idea of where are their loved ones, people that participated in the protest. And we saw from Sunday to Tuesday that people continued to go out to the streets in order to protest. But of course, after Sunday, the protest started to decrease. And for example, Inventario Project, who is specialized in data journalism reported that on July 12th, there was like 12 protests in different places of Cuba. And also there were a few in July 13th, but there's no any other report of protests recently, just a lot of militaries in the streets and a lot of people detained.
So Orlando, what was it about these protests that made it so unprecedented? We've seen protests in Cuba before, but not quite like this. Can you explain that?
Well, I'm very moved to tears by what's happening in Cuba. I would say it's a wave of emancipation. The whole continent have been seeing a lot of popular demonstrations, students, working sectors, going to the streets. Suddenly in Cuba, there is like a mantra, I would say like a evil mantra that the government expresses over and over that reads, the streets belongs only to the revolution. Namely, the streets are sequestered by the government. And suddenly, students, not the leaders of civil society, not the leaders of the traditional opposition movements, which are all of them illegal in Cuba, but the working sectors, the students, the poor classes, people that were supposed to be defending the revolution, suddenly are claiming openly, change. We want the future to belong to us. This is a generational renewal, and the revolution better be ready to assume that if they are going to have any possibility for the near future, they need to open the society to all of the sectors of the society. The Cuban Revolution cannot keep behaving like an old Cold War regime, obsolete, where all kind of dissent, and I'm not even talking of political opposition now, all kind of dissent is forbidden, stigmatized, eventually harassed, taken to prison, or forced, pushed to exile. That's not the way of running a country, especially a country so lovely like Cuba, that we are so friendly to all kind of nations, including the United States of America, which people in Cuba love Americans. And suddenly this ideological, artificial difference between Cuba and America is completely, in my opinion, constructed and fostered and manipulated by the Cuban gerontocracy, the power of the elderly.
Mm-hmm. So, Monica, the one major difference before the internet was shut down with this protest was social media. Talk a little bit about what a difference the ability to broadcast themselves made to these demonstrators.
Well, that's something that I'm trying to explain right now in a reporter that I'm doing, and it's very special what we saw last Sunday, because people who started the protest in San Antonio de los Baños, a town near Havana but not in the center of Havana, actually it's in a different province, started to broadcast what was going on there. And that transmissions, that videos started to go viral, and everyone started to share that content, and also the independent media in Cuba started to broadcast what was going on in San Antonio de los Baños. And I could say that in a couple of hours, people in different places in Cuba started to follow that example. And they just started to go out to the streets and try to find different people to start to claim for the change. It is important to highlight that people not only demanded for electricity or food or medicines, people also asked for freedom and for a change in the government and the mission of the leaders in Cuba. And of course, that was possible because of the connection to internet, the access to mobile data. That is something very, very recent in Cuba. The communication company that provided service started to give the service in December 2008. And after that date, we have seen a lot of changes in Cuba because people started to organize different feminist groups of animalists. I don't know if that's the word in English, people who defend the rights of animals. And we started to see a lot of new movements and a lot of new actions, independent actions in the civil society, and that meant a great change in our society and in our capacity for protesting and basically for practice or rights or civil rights. We suddenly had a literature of freedom that we didn't have before, and we start to expand that freedom in different ways. And of course, the government realized that that was happening very soon, and since last year especially, started to cut down internet in different moments. But in this protest, they did it right away, like a few hours after the protest got national, and they cut the internet like almost for 3 days. And right now, there's still a lot of difficulties for getting access to internet, but people are starting to post and to share the images and their experiences.
So Orlando, just in the few seconds before we go to break, do you think this has the potential for lasting change?
Absolutely. In the hearts of Cuban, this is irreversible. We are moving into the future. We are moving into freedom. Cuba is going to become a normal, not a normalized, but a normal democracy in the world. I'm completely confident of that.
All right, we will come back to that on the other side and dig deeper to why average Cubans are taking to the streets. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This hour, we're looking into the protests in Cuba and the crackdown that has followed. My guests are Orlando Pardo Lazo. He's a Cuban artist, writer, and blogger living in the U.S., and Monica Barreau, a Cuban independent journalist now living in Madrid. Ever since the government shut down the internet, accurate news, facts, and figures have been very hard to come by, both for those living in Cuba and for the rest of the world. To try to get some idea of the latest, we reached out to Patrick Oppmann, Havana bureau chief for CNN. Even on the ground, he found it hard to get exact numbers on arrests and deaths and other information.
The picture now is the island is really reeling from something that has never happened before in the history of the revolution, is that you had protests sweeping the entire island. They said again and again, no tenemos miedo, we're not afraid. That's not something you usually hear in Cuba. They shouted this at police to their face. And for once, there were more protesters than there were cops. You know, it's usually the other way around. And this time, because there were so many more people protesting, the police really couldn't close it down for quite some time. And people, maybe for the first time in their lives, had the ability to vent.
Oppmann says it's hard to know whether sporadic protests continue in other towns. But one thing is absolutely clear.
The government is cracking down. They're on high alert. Raul Castro has been called back into this. You know, he's supposedly retired, but now he's taking part in emergency meetings. You've seen other older comandantes who fought with Fidel and Raul being brought back to sort of make sure that certain provinces are under control now. And the president of Cuba, this is really his biggest test to date, is trying to show that he's a tough guy, that he's not going to put up with any of this.
Ottman says the main story now is arrests and beatings across the country.
The crackdown is well underway. The government has retaken control of the streets, and they've made it clear that if they can find anybody and everybody who was involved in this protest, that person is going to pay a price. There is a heavier police presence, certainly in Havana, where I am, and across the island. But one of the things the government here uses is they get people that are kind of these rapid response brigades, they call them. You know, it's very rough. There are people who are just sometimes armed with bats, and their job is to keep protesters from taking to the streets.
That was CNN's Patrick Ottman in Havana. I want to point out as well that despite these crackdowns that are taking place on the island, Cuba's President Miguel Díaz-Canel, according to the Associated Press, acknowledged Wednesday that government shortcomings in the lead up to the unrest played a part to this. He said in part, quote, we also have to carry out a critical analysis of our problems in order to act and overcome and avoid their repetition. So I want to turn to you, Orlando, this a little bit of acknowledgement from the Cuban president. What do you make of that?
Well, I would ask President Miguel Díaz-Canel, president appointed, not elected Díaz-Canel, what about considering at some point of his political career for life, stepping down? The people has the right to keep protesting on the street for different causes and reasons, like in any free country, like in America. It could be shortages, scarcity, but at some point, it's also about political and civil rights. It's a civil rights movement starting to develop in Cuba, and it will not stop. The crackdown certainly is going to stop the protest for days or weeks or months, but after you sense in your body, in your soul, freedom, after you get rid of the mask, it's like a simulation culture of fear that somehow becomes a culture, the culture of simulation and fear, it's irreversible. You are emancipated. And this was done by the people, not by the leaders of civil society, and the people have felt the power of the people. We are a communist country, and suddenly in the communist country, the people doesn't matter. So in this moment, I think many younger, especially younger generation, but NPR has shown here some video, has played some videos of even people in their 70s and 80s crying, mm-hmm. crying in video, saying, I didn't think I was going to live to see this. President Miguel Díaz-Canel, you are not you're not there as a vertical, monolithic ruler. You are just a server of the people, and the people will be claiming for you to step down, and we should have safe and plural elections in Cuba. Not all of Cubans are communist, and the Communist Party mm-hmm. is the only one legal in Cuba. We are also socialist. We are also social democrats. We are also conservative. Mm-hmm. We are also liberals. We all belong in Cuba.
So I want to talk about the things that led up, the factors that led up to this. And I want to play this sound from an elderly woman who said she was going to join the younger protesters and explained why.
I'm tired of being hungry, of having to struggle. I don't have water. I don't have anything. I have trouble breathing, and I look for a fan, but I can't turn it on because there's no electricity. You get tired of it all. You go crazy. I have to get an operation on my eye, and I can't find anybody to do it. I have a cataract, and I can barely see out of my other eye either.
So, Monica, the factors that led up to this are complex. There are the aspects of freedom and liberation that Orlando was just speaking to, but there are also critical food shortages, electricity shortages, infrastructure problems. Help us understand what is happening there that caused this moment on Sunday.
Well, right now in Cuba, there's a huge crisis. Of course, that is worse because of the pandemic. But the reasons, the causes of this crisis came from years ago. And I think that the government has a great responsibility in the reality that we are living in Cuba or that we are seeing in Cuba right now. Of course, the embargo has a role in what's going on, but I think that the lack of freedom, of economic freedom and political freedom, is the key to understand what is going on in Cuba, because there are a lot of solutions that people, that the society, people who live outside Cuba are providing since years ago. Also, many economists and other specialists are trying to explain to the government what is possible to do in Cuba in order to advance, in order to change the reality and provide quality to the people who is living in Cuba. And the government just don't listen what the specialists, what the professionals are saying since a lot of years ago. And we saw yesterday that they approved the importation of different products, especially food and medicines from outside. Mm-hmm. But this is something that people were claiming since months ago in order to respond to the lack of everything, not only medicines and food, there are also a lack of condoms, for example, and that's a huge issue because affects directly the health of people and the quality of their lives. So there are a lot of causes, but I think that the main cause of this crisis is the lack of freedom, because people want to participate in the solution of the problems. People want to take the control of their lives and want to determine the destiny of the nation, and the government just don't listen what the people has to say, what the people wants. Yeah.
So I want to bring in Richard Feinberg into the conversation. He's a professor emeritus of international political economy at UC San Diego, and he's worked in the White House, State and Treasury departments in the Ford, Carter, and Clinton administrations, and was a senior director for Inter-American Affairs for the National Security Council under President Clinton. Richard, welcome.
Nice to be with you, Kim.
And so we're talking about the causes. Of course, one cause that some claim is a factor on this is U.S. policy, both the ongoing embargo as well as some of the executive actions that former President Trump took during his administration. Can you talk about that and give your thoughts?
Sure. In terms of the causes of the economic crisis on the island, of course, mismanagement by the socialist economy over many decades is an important underlying factor. But I was listening to U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken the other day saying the United States has nothing to do with what's going on in the Cuban economy. That's a spectacularly disingenuous statement. The U.S. for decades, but particularly the Trump administration, did everything it could to strangle the small Cuban economy. We've also been supporting dissident groups on the island and their relations in South Florida very publicly, also for many years. So it's spectacularly disingenuous to say that the U.S. has nothing to do with the current crisis on the island. Now, Biden did promise during his campaign to relax some of the restrictions on U.S. travel, on remittances that Cuban Americans can send to their relatives. Those factors would be very important in alleviating the economic crisis on the island. So far, Biden has not acted, presumably out of fear of a reaction by the hardliners among the Cuban American community in South Florida. But I do expect that he will take some action in the coming weeks to alleviate the sufferings of the Cuban people.
So here was President Biden speaking about this earlier this week.
The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba. as they assert their universal rights. And we call on the government, of Cuba, to refrain from violence or attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba.
So the Biden administration, the president himself, has voiced strong support for the rights of these demonstrators to speak and protest. But Richard, it only would take a stroke of a pen to, at the very least, lift some of these restrictions from the Trump administration, which folks I've spoke to say is at the very least made it more difficult to get these supplies, to get the food, and to allow Cuban Americans to send money to Cubans. Why do you think it is that hesitation? Is it just politics? Is it just the fear of what voters in Florida might do?
Essentially, Kim, yes, that U.S. policy towards Cuba has for many years been driven more by domestic politics than by foreign policy concerns and the actual impact on the island. After all, we've been trying economic sanctions, comprehensive, tough economic sanctions, for six decades. Have they produced democracy in Cuba? Not that I've noticed. So why do we keep pursuing a policy that clearly is not achieving the foreign policy objectives? And the answer to that is domestic politics, that it feeds the anger, the frustrations, the desire for vengeance on the part of a segment of the Cuban-American community in South Florida. Then you also have certain members of Congress responsive to the Cuban-American community in important positions, most notably Robert Menendez, who chairs the very powerful Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Powerful particularly from the point of view of the State Department, because that committee has to approve all of the senior State Department appointments, both within the State Department and all the ambassadors worldwide. So there's a hesitancy to cross Robert Menendez.
So, Orlando, you are here in the United States. You left Cuba in 2013. What do you think about the way that U.S. politics are affecting U.S. policy toward Cuba?
It's not relevant right now. The U.S. policy is not determining the destiny of my nation. Americans tend to think that they control every little country. It's kind of, I don't know, if liberal imperialism. Washington is not defining the will of freedom of my people. Washington is not strangling my people. They are simply denying financial credit to the government, to the same Cuban government that is not paying its debt with Russia, that is not paying its debt with China. But in any case, if you listen to the protesters, which is what is important here, not whatever is going on in Washington, D.C., or in academia, or in the mainstream media in America, if you listen to them video after video, I have been listening for hours without sleeping, crying in my place. They are not claiming about U.S. sanctions. They are claiming about Cuba sanctions against the Cuban people that are not related to that. The U.S. embargo is simply affecting financial credits to the Cuban government. The Cuban government is buying a lot, millions of dollars in food to America, and millions of dollars in medicine, only that they need to pay in advance, kind of in cash, because the U.S. government, for historical reasons, yes, political reasons, is not to please the domestic policy, it's to respect the will of Cubans here, just like the U.S. government is very aware and respectful of other minorities in America. And so making this about a conversation about lifting the sanction is a way of instrumentalizing, manipulating, and somehow misrepresenting the demonstrations in Cuba. We need to be free. We need to be free at last after 60 years of communism, with or without embargo. When the Cuban government or when the U.S. government lifts the sanctions and when the Cuban government democratizes, we still have the right to take the streets and claim from our rights. We are no less than Americans, no less than Americans. Well, please, don't discriminate. Orlando. Don't look over the shoulder. To us.
Right. No, but I want to get Monica's input on this, too. Do you agree with that? Do you believe that this is not an American problem at all, or that America plays a role here?
Well, I don't deny the fact that the embargo and the sanctions have impacted the reality of every Cuban, and especially the common people. But I think that at the end of the day, what really affects the embargo is the capacity of the government to control the economy. Because the vision that the government has of the country is that they have to control everything, the production, the farms, the importation of everything, the exportation of everything, the investments. So in the vision of the government, the embargo has a key role because doesn't allow them to make all the things that they believe they could do if they didn't have the embargo. But my point in this conflict all the time is that with the embargo, even with all the sanctions that Trump put in his administration, there are a lot of measures that we can take in order to develop the economy, in order to
I'm going to hold you right there and we'll come back on the other side. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about birds. In many eastern states, a mysterious disease is killing songbirds. Scientists still don't understand what's going on. And more broadly, bird populations are on the decline in North America. Birds are strong indicators of the health of our natural world. So to watch them decline tells us a lot about our future. We'll dive in. So are you a birder? What does birding bring to your life? And how do you experience and enjoy the birds? Which ones are your favorite? And are you witnessing their decline? Or maybe you don't enjoy birds so much. Why not? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we've been talking about the extraordinary outburst of popular anger in Cuba. My guests are Orlando Pardo Lazo. He's a Cuban artist, writer, and blogger living in the U.S. and Monica Barro, a Cuban independent journalist now living in Madrid. And we're also joined by Richard Feinberg, a professor emeritus at UC San Diego. So, Richard, I want to go back to you just to get a reaction from Orlando to Orlando and Monica's view about the U.S.'s role here.
Well, there's no doubt that the average Cuban's economic situation is deteriorating in part because of purposeful U.S. sanctions. Cuban Americans can't send remittances to their friends and relatives on the island, that hurts their friends and relatives on the island. If U.S. tourists can't visit the island, attend restaurants that are part of the emerging private sector, that, of course, hurts business in the private sector on the island. So that's obviously a very important factor. Now, is it also true, of course, that the Cuban government itself bears a lot of responsibility? And one thing, let me point out, I think there have been some important missed opportunities, both on the part so far of the Biden administration, which has so far not reverted back, as was generally expected, to the Obama policies of engagement and dialogue, which had produced positive results on the island, both political and economic. So some missed opportunities there so far. But also, the government in Cuba had opportunities to dialogue with the intellectuals, who had a very famous demonstration in front of the Ministry of Culture a few months back. They also had an opportunity to dialogue with the emerging private sector. As was mentioned by Monica, there was an intent to begin economic reform about a decade ago, but the government got cold feet and halted and even reversed some of those market-oriented economic reforms. So missed opportunities on both sides. As a result, particularly from the point of view of the Cuban government, their options are now more limited. Díaz-Canel, the new president, has been around for about 2 years or so, has not shown the leadership, the willingness to move forward to undertake important reforms. Just the opposite. He's emphasized continuity, mainly that I am the same as Raúl Castro. That's not what most Cubans, certainly not what most young Cubans want to hear.
So is there any lasting impact from that change in policy that we saw during the Obama administration, which in many ways, I mean, I was able to travel to Cuba during that time, sort of opened America up to a lot of Cubans in a new way and vice versa. Is there any lasting impact from that? And what might we see? How might that play a role in what Biden may do?
Well, Biden, during his campaign, suggested that he would try to revert back to many of Obama's policies. He very specifically said he would allow a return of travel and of remittances. So far, as we've already emphasized, that hasn't happened, I think, largely for domestic politics. I'm afraid a lasting effect of the swings in American policy, an opening under Obama, but then a dramatic closing under Trump, and now hesitancy under Obama, leaves the Cuban government thinking, hey, we don't have a reliable interlocutor in the United States. Who can we trust to implement sustained policies? By the way, that's a problem for U.S. foreign policy, not only in Cuba these days, but worldwide as we swing so dramatically back and forth between different policy paradigms.
Yeah. So, Monica, I want to talk about these uprisings and what led to them from a cultural perspective. It seems to be driven, as Orlando said, by young people, by individuals, by citizens in a way that's different in the past. Can you describe that a little bit more?
I think that the main difference that we have seen during this social outbreak is the fact that most of the people that took the streets were not intellectuals, were not the same people that we used to see in other protests that took place a few years ago. For example, I participated in the protest of May 11, 2019 in defense of sexual diversity. And most of the people that were there were friends of mine. I knew most of them. And also on November 27 last year, most of the people that protagonized a protest outside the Ministry of Culture in Havana were artists, activists, journalists, and also the same community that were already a target from the State Security Department. And right now, there was no call from any opposition group. There was no leadership. There was no visual face of the traditional dissidents. The protests that we saw in recent days were ruled by common people, by people that we didn't knew who they were. And I think that's like the main difference. We are not seeing like the traditional dissidents, the traditional artists and journalists. Actually, most of them were facing a police repression in their homes, and they didn't were able of getting out to the streets, and they were with the internet access shut down. And the videos and the transmissions that we saw on social networks were made by people that we didn't know who they were. So I think that's the most important difference with what we were seeing years ago.
And the people who came out were everyday people who were also pushing against this crackdown that we saw follow the protests. In this case, let's listen to a man who said he was out on the street to protect protesters from the police. The people came out to express themselves freely, and the police are oppressing and beating them, and that is unacceptable, and we are here, and we do not allow them to beat them. Orlando, talk about more about who are leading these protests, and also, look, we're seeing protests happen among Cuban Americans in Miami and other parts of the United States, in part because of these images and sounds from social media. Talk about what that means.
Well, we are a single nation on the island and in exile, a single nation divided by many issues, but a single nation. So is solidarity, I think, is always beautiful. I hope Americans are also compassionate and caring about what's going on in Cuba right now. People are being shot in the street. People are being arrested. Massive arrests. Hundreds of arrests are taking place. We don't know all of the names yet. But to focus on U.S. politics is somehow to give the power of narrative to the Cuban government. The Cuban government is the only one speaking of the embargo right now on the island. There is a generational shift. Please, Americans, consider the future of our nation. We are a neighboring nation. We are very happy to be open to America and that America open to us. But please, Americans, please, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, do not give money to a regime that is repressive. I think U.S. is giving enough money to repressors worldwide. Make an exception with Cuba. Do not support, do not financially support the Cuban government just for the reason of being afraid of a migratory crisis, just for trying to appease a violator of human rights. Please, maybe this is the moment to be a little more compassionate and listening to what's actually happening in the streets of Cuba. Let's forget a little about Miami and listen a little more to the many towns and cities in Cuba that are expressing a faith in democracy and a trust that America is going to do the right thing for my people on the island. With the
so Orlando, what is the right thing? I take it that
Orlando supports U.S. economic sanctions against Cuba. I assure you that is
no,
not
wrong.
The position.
You are wrong, sir.
Do you favor the U.S. embargo or not? Yes.
Please,
or no?
do not assume that is wrong. I do not support the U.S. embargo. You are totally wrong, and you are misrepresenting me.
I'm glad to hear
that. So hang on just one moment. Let's pause for just one moment. I want to hear Orlando explain what he would like the U.S. to do. We are clear that he opposes does not want financial support given. Orlando, how – this is a U.S. – this is a U.S. program. This is U.S. listeners predominantly. Tell them what you think the U.S. ought to do.
Yes. Be Americans and support democratic values worldwide, including Cuba. You don't need to give financial credit to a violator of human rights. I repeat, America is supporting enough violators of human rights worldwide. Let's make an exception with Cuba. There is a unique opportunity for the Biden administration to make a difference that could not be fulfilled by the Trump administration. This is the moment to open up to Cuba, but with a creative policy, compassionate, caring about the people, caring about why we cannot organize ourselves in companies in Cuba, in enterprises in Cuba, caring about why is always Cubans behaving like a parasite state, receiving remittances instead of being a country that could create its own wealth. So there need to be a lot of financial pressure on the government because we don't want the U.S. money to end up buying all this anti-riot and tanks and military weapons and the intelligence in Cuba. We want the U.S. money if it's going to be flowing to Cuba, and I'm very welcome. Okay. We welcome Americans to travel. That money needs to be used creatively. Do not support the Cuban government. Support the Cuban people and the Cuban emerging civil society.
Okay, I want to give Richard a chance to respond to that position. Go ahead, Richard.
If Orlando, I heard him suggest that he favors allowing U.S. travelers to visit Cuba, and I think he favors allowing remittances to friends and family as well, which was really the heart of the Obama policies and what Biden had also promised. That would also support the private sector that I think Orlando suggested was valuable, because they require remittances for investment and they require visitors from the United States and elsewhere as consumers. But I think we have to ask ourselves, really, what are the scenarios that we're looking for here? Do we really think that the Cuban government, which after all we've always described as a really tough, unified communist regime, that they are just going to say, oh, the people are in the streets, so we sort of give up and let's have free and fair elections tomorrow? Is that likely to happen? It seems to me not likely scenario. Do we want a situation of popular uprising and bloodshed, which could result in a massive immigration crisis? You've already heard calls in South Florida for U.S. military intervention. That I can tell you from my time in the government, the very last thing the Pentagon wants is to have to send 100,000 troops into Cuba. We just withdrew 3,000 troops from Afghanistan. The last thing we want to do is a massive intervention in a Caribbean island. So we have to look for a more modest, soft landing in Cuba. And that really, I think the statements coming out of the Biden administration actually have been rather restrained. They have not been trying to fuel the flames of a massive popular uprising. Rather, I think they look for more gradual reform. And that is a logical policy for the U.S. government to follow at this time. So the opposition in Cuba, which I totally agree with what the other speakers have suggested, that this was a much larger and more broader based set of demonstrations than we had seen in the past. The government is clearly concerned. The president and his ministers have been on TV every day for hours recognizing the problems and trying to explain what they're doing. Inadequate. The government has not shown a willingness to really open up either economically or politically. That's a big mistake. But the issue is now, will the government recognize that it has to open up and dialogue with broader sectors of the economy and society? That's what we can hope for. If not, it's just dark days for Cuba ahead.
So, Monica, I want to give you the last word. What do you expect to happen now? The protests are dying down, but what do you think is next in Cuba?
Well, according to our experience, I think that what we're going to see next is going to be bigger if the government doesn't change their policies. Because on November 27, we thought that was a great protest, that was like an incredible moment. But last Sunday, we saw something even bigger. And we also saw a lot of violence and a lot of repression. And the conclusion that I can take from all this is that while the government increases repression, the opposition to the government also increases. And in the other hand, people in the U.S. that thought that the embargo was not the solution are starting to think that it's actually the solution. And there are a lot of people who think that because of the embargo,
we're going to have to unfortunately leave it there. Monica, thank you so much for joining us. Monica Barreau, Orlando Pardo Lazo, and Richard Feinberg. Thanks to all of our guests for joining us today. You can continue the conversation by getting our app on onpointradio.org. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.